Wow, Alec is always a first for everything, and that was some introduction. We go back a long way. You were a business journalist back in the day, and you've stuck true to the profession. I was a political journalist, and some would say I have regressed somewhat since then. But we had a great time in the bad old days in that pioneering newspaper, the Rand Daily Mail, where we worked day and night to try and bring about what eventually happened in South Africa against all the odds. We were a country irrevocably on the course of a racial civil war. And if we could avoid that, the Everests before us are surmountable. So, Alec and the BizNews team, ladies and gentlemen, I regard it as a great honor to have been asked to give the opening address at this conference. Let me quickly add, however, that at BizNews there is great risk in speaking before the rest of the lineup, some of whom are among my most relentless political opponents. I recall sitting somewhere near the front of the BizNews auditorium in 2023, listening to them lambasting me, and they really were. But I was totally chilled because I knew I would be speaking last. Today, I have no such safety net. You will also be relieved to hear that I have no intention of taking my revenge today. There are, in the current climate, far more important topics to be talking about. We all know about the famous curse the Chinese are said to reserve for their enemies. May you live in interesting times. Today I'm going to speak about the ancient Irish curse, which, like most things Irish, adds a twist and takes it to the next level. When they want to curse you, they say, may you live in somebody else's interesting times. The Irish curse has suddenly become a global reality as the world tries to make sense of a new order that is sweeping away institutional foundations carefully crafted over the past 80 years to bring stability, contain wars, and defend democracy. Most people alive today have always lived within this international framework. For Western democracies, it has provided a protective cocoon. But as the old certainties are swept away, no one can foresee how this revolutionary chapter in the 21st century will end. And that is no exaggeration. We are entering a revolutionary chapter worldwide. In South Africa, we have an advantage, as Alex said at the beginning. We are used to living with extreme uncertainty. We have survived interesting times ever since this far-flung tip of the African continent decided against all odds to form a single country and try to build a common nationhood within its borders. No country in comparable circumstances has ever succeeded in this quest. But with our typical can-do attitude, many of us still believe we can, and I most certainly do. We are assisted by our understanding that there really is no viable alternative. Actually, in present circumstances, South Africa might turn out to be one of the safer places on the planet in the years ahead, at least from a military perspective. As we all know, America is expecting some refugees from our shores soon, but I'm expecting some returnees too. What's more, I'm prepared to wager that over the course of the next century, our experience will be instructive, perhaps even illuminating, to other countries seeking to accommodate growing diversity. Despite the global attempts to slow down and reverse the trend of international migration, prosperous Western countries will ultimately have to face challenges that South Africans have grappled with for decades. The result of the 2024 US election was a signal that the majority of Americans have, for now, given up trying. The past 50 years have been shaped by America's attempt to make Western liberal democracy the world's default position for a successful nation state. And here I use the phrase liberal democracy not in the perverted American sense of left-wing identity politics, also known as wokeness, which is a curse to liberalism. By liberal democracy, I mean governance that is rooted in the political and moral philosophy of individual rights and freedoms, the rule of law, equality before the law, and the right to private property in a market-based economy. From Vietnam to Afghanistan over half a century, the American attempt to impose these values internationally has failed. The re-election of Donald Trump, the ultimate disruptor, tells us that most Americans now believe that quest is futile. They are retreating behind their own borders, safeguarding their immediate sphere of influence, keeping others out, and accepting the right of other superpowers to do the same. Either we are living through a fleeting, if extremely disruptive, interlude until the USA's liberal DNA reasserts itself, or we are making a transition into a new world order dominated by three oligarchs: Trump, Putin, and Xi, each representing and defending each other's rights to run their neighborhoods in what they interpret as their national interest, while the rest of the world tries to work out how to get by and survive in the cracks. As Trump seeks to annex Greenland and make Canada his 51st state, he will also, perhaps inadvertently, defend Putin's right to do the same in Eastern Europe and China's in Taiwan. The big question we face is whether we are entering a new world order based on an oligarchic balance of influence and interests, and if so, what that means for the rest of the world. Whatever prediction we dare to make, we have to face the fact that an internationally disengaged, self-focused United States has major implications for us all. The termination, for example, of U.S. aid and the possible end of our access to U.S. markets through AGOA are merely a foretaste of what lies ahead. It is useful to understand history as a series of pendulum swings. For decades, the pendulum may swing evenly across its arc, held in place by the gravitational pull of legitimate international institutions. But once or twice in a century, the pendulum swings with such force that its amplitude pulls the existing international order off its axis, presaging a turbulence that fundamentally changes the way the world works. I think it is safe to say that the age of democratic nation building and global adventures for that purpose is over, and a new age of great power rivalry has begun. Some people have labeled this neo-realism in a post-liberal world. Neo-realism in a post-liberal world that has profound implications. Trump has been its catalyst and exemplifier. Henry Kissinger, shortly before he died, captured it perfectly when he said, "I think Trump may be one of those figures in history who appears from time to time to mark the end of an era and to force it to give up on its old pretenses. It doesn't necessarily mean that he knows this or that he is considering any great alternative. It could just be an accident." But as we know, much of history happens by accident, and when it does, it is always extremely difficult to predict the outcome with any certainty, because events simply take over. Now, I saw an interesting advert for Bitcoin as I walked through the door, and my son made me invest in Bitcoin a couple of years ago, for which I am still very grateful, despite the recent slump in the value of Bitcoin. But nevertheless, I think Bitcoin will provide a remarkably useful barometer of the Trump years. Initially, Bitcoin soared because Trump was seen to be its champion. On last Friday, on the 7th of March, it was supposed to have soared again, but in fact, it tanked really badly because instead of buying new Bitcoin to add to the United States' reserve currency, they simply took forfeited assets to do that, and the expected boom did not arise, and in fact, it went the other way. And it plummeted even further when Mr. Trump yesterday refused to rule out the possibility of a recession as a result of the trade war that he has unleashed. So another one of history's events happened in the Oval Office a week before the 7th. That was on the 28th of February between President Zelensky and Donald Trump. Let me be clear on this. Russia is the aggressor. It has invaded a sovereign democratic state with the objective of ceding at least some of its territory, redirecting its foreign policy, and overthrowing its government. If Trump thinks that he can win a Nobel Peace Prize or build international credibility as a dealmaker by strong-arming a deal on Ukraine while refusing to stand up to Putin, all he is doing is strengthening Russia's position. And if Trump's plan is to force Ukraine to relinquish territory while preventing it from joining NATO, then all he is doing is asking Ukraine to surrender. Europe got that message loud and clear. 2 days after the Oval Office bust-off, 15 European heads of state, along with Justin Trudeau of Canada, the heads of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the European Union, held a summit in London that could itself yet be looked back on as a moment of great historical consequence. A future for NATO without America. The result is an 800 billion euro defense investment plan called Rearm Europe, and the resuscitation of the arms race. In the absence of a deal on Ukraine, the coalition of the willing, as Keir Starmer described the group, appears willing to do something that it has avoided up till now, putting their own boots on the ground to fight the Russians in Ukraine. So long as the majority of Europe and Canada remain united, there is at least a fourth major power bloc to balance the global tripartite alliance of the oligarchs Trump, Putin, and Xi. And this fourth bloc is set to become more formidable as it races to rearm. Now Europe is on a collision course to a possible war with Russia over roughly 100,000 square kilometers of Ukrainian territory to deter further expansion by Putin as he tries to claw back the fallen Warsaw Pact. And Trump has put himself into a position where he gets to pick the winner. But let us also not forget a fifth emerging power bloc in the world today, the Islamic State, Iran and its radical Islamic allies across the Middle East. They are obviously less powerful than the other four, but they are more hostile to America and less predictable. And they are, with South Africa's alleged cooperation, developing nuclear capability. They are unlikely to win a major war, but they may well start one. In a major development, again on Friday the 7th, President Trump sent a letter to Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khomeini, urging him to reach a deal with the U.S. on its nuclear program. On Fox's Business Network, I suppose their version of BizNews, on Fox's Business Network, Trump said, "I've written them," that's the Iranians, "a letter saying I hope you negotiate, because if we have to go in militarily, it's going to be a terrible thing for them." I'll repeat that because these are really ominous words. "I've written them a letter saying I hope you negotiate, because if we have to go in militarily, it is going to be a terrible thing." The Financial Times described the letter as the most concrete public step the Trump administration has taken with respect to Iran and its allies after he announced last month that he was reimposing his so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran, including sanctions on the international network shipping Iranian oil to China, which they don't like one little bit, obviously. The president told Fox he was not ruling out a military intervention, but would rather negotiate a deal. And then he added, "We can make a deal that would be just as good as if you won militarily." For its part, Tehran has committed itself to continuing the nuclear program, fearing that America's ultimate goal is to overturn the Islamic State. For his part, then, Trump has made it clear he is committed to preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons at any cost. And this obviously creates a very flammable situation. In this extremely tense context, it would not have escaped Washington's attention that just as Trump issued his veiled warnings to Iran, the ANC was hosting an Iranian delegation at Lutuli House, headed by the Iranian ambassador to South Africa, Mansour Shakib Meir. Our own Nomvula Mokonyane, who chairs the International Relations Portfolio Committee in Parliament, hosted the delegation and announced that the ANC will maintain its ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran regardless of any sanctions imposed by the US. She said the meeting was about consolidating strategic relations between the ANC and Iran, nothing to do with South Africa, the ANC and Iran. Now recall that South Africa exports just under 300 million worth of goods to Iran, compared to the almost 157 billion our country exports to the United States. Given these numbers and what is at stake for our country at this time, I kept asking myself whether the timing was just the ANC being clueless again, or whether they were deliberately poking the bear. It is worth mentioning that during the negotiations to set up the GNU, the ANC was obsessed with retaining the international relations portfolio, more so than any other. Let me tell you, there is far more that goes on behind the veil of that portfolio than is publicly acknowledged. So it is not far-fetched to see a future of war between Europe and Russia, together with escalating conflict in the Middle East. This could even be comparable to the Second World War's dual fronts in Europe and the Pacific. I say that not to fearmonger or sensationalize, but for us to be honest about the threat that lies ahead if calm heads do not prevail. Perhaps it is the idealist in me, but I do think that this collision course will be interrupted for the better. However, the very worst case scenario is now a possibility, and that fact alone should be enough for us to identify that threat, speak its name, and think about what is required to avoid it. This moment requires sane, rational dialogue and critical thinking. That is the only way we will avoid a global calamity. Meanwhile, China is happy to do what it has always done, sit on the sidelines and wait it out, as its economy grows in strength while its enemies finance their wars. If South Africa is to chart a course in these perilous waters, it is obvious that we cannot sit back and allow the ANC to drive our foreign policy in its own party interests. The stakes, simply put, are far too high. That is why the DA sent its own delegation to Washington recently, where we had meetings at a very senior level to ensure that we keep the channels of communication open and provide an alternative perspective to that beamed to the world from Luthuli House. We have to because the ANC is absolutely determined to keep us out of foreign policy, which we believe will have profoundly negative consequences for South Africa, as it already has. And this won't be the last of the international delegations we will be undertaking to fight South Africa's corner, while the ANC promotes its party interests over South Africa's. But back home, we have had a paradigm shift of our own, and of course that is the GNU. The 2024 election was emblematic of the trend that we are seeing in the international sphere. People are growing more fearful, and when they become more fearful, they tend to become more tribal and insular. And the way in which the flow of information works these days means that politics happens in polarizing bubbles. It is increasingly difficult to win support for more moderate liberal positions in this environment. The same held true in South Africa. The Zulu nationalist MKP came in like a wrecking ball, seeking revenge, and won almost 15% of the vote. The Coloured Nationalist Patriotic Alliance, which has existed since 2013, has suddenly also found electoral resonance. Both it and the National Coloured Congress won seats in Parliament for the first time last year. But the DA bucked the international trend. Back at the DA's federal head office, we've recently done a comparative deep dive into the state of liberal politics globally. With 22% of the vote, the DA stands as one of the best performing liberal parties on the planet. Our growth in the context of a liberal retreat worldwide and the rise of fringe politics is an exception on the international stage, so we mustn't beat up too much on ourselves. When you look at the handful of other liberal parties that have maintained some success in this era, they tend to exist in more homogeneous, wealthier, and safer societies. South Africa is none of the above. To forge a liberal offering in our context is something that no one else has replicated. We are a global outlier at this moment in time, and we have been actually for many years and will continue to be. The reason why we have been able to do it is because we have held our liberal backbone in the Democratic Alliance when most other liberal parties worldwide have not. They have bent and succumbed to the cancer of identity politics, pretending to be progressive. We in the DA have resisted both the regression of wokeness and the lure of narrow racial nationalism. We have stayed true to ourselves and what we believe in, that most South Africans want to flourish in a non-racial constitutional democracy that protects everybody's rights and freedoms. That put us in a position to capitalize when the ANC did what all liberation movements eventually do, which is fracture, fail, and fall. They have not reached the end of that downward path yet, and there is a lot more push that we have to exert. Hence, the GNU. Let me be frank. The GNU has been difficult, and that is an understatement. We knew that the ANC would play dirty, but the ANC has fallen below even my very low expectations of it. However difficult the GNU is for us, however imperfect what comes out of it, the alternative to what we have now is a coalition of Paul Mashatile, Jacob Zuma, and Julius Malema. That would seal the deal in South Africa's trend towards state failure. It would seal the deal for expropriation without compensation. It would be the end of private healthcare, private education, and the protection of minority rights. It would be the end of any hopes of revival for our economy or credibility on the international stage. it would institutionalize and industrialize corruption as we've never seen it before. I know the DA has come under fire for what are perceived to be defeats on Bella, on the Expropriation Act, and the National Health Insurance Act. This is not an entirely accurate perception. We have gained ground on all three, which I will come to later. But it is important to note that all three of these laws were essentially done deals before the GNU was negotiated. They had already been passed in the 6th Parliament, and all they needed was the President's signature. Obviously, that limited our leverage severely. The ANC did not need our votes to pass any of them. The President only had to sign them. The first time that the ANC actually needed our votes in Parliament was to pass the current budget. They thought we would cave if the clock ran out. That's what the ANC does. It runs down the clock and then puts on the pressure at the last minute. But we point blank refused to accept a 2% increase in VAT as the basis of their expansionary budget. And so it collapsed. Enoch Godongwana has been on record saying that the finance minister does not negotiate the budget. We disagree. In a coalition, the budget is the most important thing you negotiate. Politics, after all, is defined by how government prioritizes the spending of public money. Ashok Sarupan, our doughty Deputy Minister of Finance, has been leading the charge for us. And by tomorrow, we will know how much ground he has been able to win. We will also know whether we will vote for that budget or against it. Ashok is rightfully very wary of sharing information about the negotiations at this stage because of their extreme market sensitivity. All I can tell you today for sure is that it will go right down to the wire. We can also tell you that South Africa does not have a revenue problem. We have a spending problem. Billions are wasted every year on corruption, bloated bureaucracies, and inefficient programs. And there is little accountability for waste. And the ANC can be sure, unless there are clear and concrete plans to fundamentally change this trajectory of waste and corruption, we will stand our ground. In an ideal world, we would win all of our demands. And we've made a lot of them. You could see me turning over the page because I'm not allowed to put them out there now because of the market sensitivity. But in an ideal world, we would win them all. But this is not an ideal world. We got 22% of the vote last year, not 51%, unfortunately. We can win some things, but we can't win everything. And this is the part of coalitions that many voters find very difficult to accept. If we want to win 100% of the time, we must get 51% of the votes. However, now for the first time, the ANC also cannot get its own way on everything either. In this context, people must ask themselves, is it better for the DA to be in the GNU or for us to be replaced by the EFF and MK? The answer to me is pretty obvious. Our presence in the GNU means the DA Minister of Education is writing the regulations, norms and standards that will provide the framework for the implementation of the Bella Act. It means that the DA fight back against the NHI plan to phase out medical aids is a fight that we can win despite the present obstinacy of the incumbent minister. And it means challenging the Expropriation Act in court on constitutional grounds that most assure us of victory. We are engaged in guerrilla warfare, not a set-piece battle. We will do our very best to win as much as we can in every skirmish. And in next year's local government election, we have set our sights on becoming the biggest party in South Africa's major metros. We are the only party that can beat the ANC, and it would change the trajectory of our country to have the major metros in Gauteng and elsewhere under the guidance of a DA executive mayor. But apart from anything else, we believe that our philosophy is the only one in which a divided, culturally diverse society stands any chance of achieving peace and prosperity. Partition is a pipe dream. Let's not waste time going down rabbit holes. Let's rather build on the pillars of our major cities, growing in stability and prosperity, following the Cape Town model to make South Africa great. Not again, but for the very first time in our constitutional democracy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Helen. There was so much in that that we could unpack, but I think the most important one is to stay here in South Africa first. We've got the budget coming. We have guerrilla warfare, as you call it. Can you give us some kind of parameters that are not negotiable? Mark Burke, your spokesman, said we will not stand for any increase in VAT. We hear strong rumors now that there's been a deal and that we are going to get 0.75% increase in VAT. If that happens, why would that be the case?
Let me say this. We still have to determine whether or not we will support the budget. We are very serious about using the opportunities that we have where the ANC really needs our votes, not to allow ourselves to be driven over roughshod. The risk we faced was the possibility of the EFF doing a deal with the ANC and even MK doing a deal with the ANC around the budget. But looking at their statements today, it seems that that is not the case. So that is not a risk that I think we have to face. That gives us even more leverage, which is very important to have in these situations. As I say, it is not a done deal. And if the ANC pushes its luck and doesn't come with a clear plan to make sure that government spending is reined in, to make sure that blockages to economic growth are removed, and to make sure that people don't have to pay more and more for an expansionary, wasteful budget under a corrupt government, we will draw the line and we will make sure that the ANC can't continue business as usual.
What happens then? What happens if there is no budget passed on Wednesday?
Well, what happens if there is no budget passed on Wednesday? And yesterday I spoke to the lawyers and I asked them to map out an entire trajectory for me. There are a number of votes that have to happen. There is, as everybody knows, the appropriation vote, in which every single departmental vote is debated in Parliament and then voted on individually. And then the budget as a whole has to be voted on and debated. And that's a very tough debate. And after that comes the Division of Revenue Act, which is a very important one. The Division of Revenue vote in Parliament decides how the money is going to be distributed between the national government and the nine provinces. And at every one of those, we can decide to vote for if we've got the concessions we're demanding, or we can withhold our vote again. So down these series of crucial votes that will follow for at least 3 to 4 months, and then you've got the appropriation at the very end of the year, the adjustment budget, as we call it. At every one of those, we can flex our muscle, we can hold firm, we can say no until we get the concessions we want. We're in a much stronger position now than we were with Bella, or that we were with NHI, or that we were with EWC. But I'm sure we'll win a lot on the fights that we're still putting up on those three.
From what you said now and what you said from the podium, it sounds like coalition politics begins today or begins here.
Yes, coalition politics requires that you have muscle. You can't win everything, but you've got to win some things. And to have muscle, you've got to hold the balance of power. So there are lots of smaller parties. There are 10 parties that have been bought into this government of national unity. But without being rude to any of the rest of them, it doesn't really matter what they think and say because they don't have the balance of power. It matters what the DA says because we can defeat a vote in parliament. We've got 87 votes in parliament that the ANC can't get a majority without unless it brings in the EFF plus all the smaller parties or MK. And it doesn't look as if they'll be able to do that on the budget right now. So our vote really matters. And that is where coalition politics really begins.
We've all seen the cartoons of Donald Trump playing chess and Cyril Ramaphosa playing drafts on the same board. How do your negotiations with the ANC stack up? Are one of you playing chess and the other one drafts?
You know, I never know whether the ANC is being inconceivably devious or whether they are just totally incompetent. And it's a toss-up between the two, probably a combination, actually. I mean, let me give you an example. I was negotiating the terms of reference for the clearinghouse mechanism, which is supposed to be a conflict resolution mechanism within the government of national unity. And these discussions were happening last Friday. And of course, on the very morning the negotiations happen, all the papers arrive, always on the morning. And then 20 minutes before the negotiation was supposed to begin, another paper arrives in the inbox. And if it wasn't for my eagle-eyed office manager, Janine Skull, spotting that coming in, I wouldn't have even read it before we started the meeting. And slipped in one of those sub-clauses was a proposal to remove the sufficient consensus clause of the DA that we had negotiated in the statement of intent. The most important clause for us. Now, I don't know if they are just totally incompetent and cannot get things together until 20 minutes before the meeting, or whether that is entirely deliberate and they wanted me to miss it and then they could say, well, we sent it. And when we said, has everybody accept the terms of reference? And I'd said, yes, that would have been me. So you've got to be on your toes the whole time. You've got to read all the documents. And another great thing the ANC does is you read all the documents and they make you think you're making progress. And 5 minutes to midnight, they produce a totally new document that they want to slip through from pressure from the president. And we're not playing that game anymore. We're not playing that game anymore.
Let's look at the international scene and indeed the way that South Africa has been handling the Trump administration. If you were the Minister of Foreign Affairs, how would you do things differently?
Firstly, it is important to understand what is going on. And it is really difficult at the moment. I read a lot about politics globally and locally. And to work out what is going on is extremely difficult in the current circumstances. Look at poor Canada. Let's just take a look at Canada. On Sunday, Mark Carney was elected the new leader of the Liberal Party to succeed Justin Trudeau. Justin Trudeau, in January, thought that the polls had the Conservative Party moving 25% ahead of him. So he thought, well, he doesn't want to preside over a massive defeat in the election that has to happen this year in Canada, he'd rather resign, which he did. Mark Carney was elected on Sunday. Now, because of President Trump's tariff and trade war against Canada, the Conservative Party in Canada has plunged and the Liberals are just ahead, which is an extraordinary turnaround. So everyone would have thought, okay, with Trump in the White House, the Conservatives in Canada are going to be unstoppable. Precisely the opposite has happened. because Trump has unleashed a trade war. It has caused a domestic economic crisis to the point that Trump says he can't rule out a recession. Canada immediately slapped on a 25% tariff on the energy they export and other things they export to America. And you've got a totally different outcome from the one everyone expected. So when you're a minister of foreign affairs, you've got to know what's going on. You've got to have people at the highest level in the major partners that we have to find out what's going on from the inside. You have to look at what South Africa's interests are, not your own party. South Africa can gain nothing from cozying up to Iran at this time. Absolutely nothing. There is no advantage in it. And look, I don't want to say anything that I can't absolutely staff, as they say in Afrikaans, with numbers and figures. But it's not a coincidence, I don't believe, that while Nomvula Mokonyane was hosting the Iranian delegation on behalf of the ANC at Luthuli House, it was reported that the ANC could no longer pay its staff anymore and that they bankrupt again. Now, I just join these dots and I draw conclusions that I'm sure the BizNews audience is clever enough to draw for themselves. So you've got to put the country's interests first. And the country's interests are economic growth and job creation. That's number one, two, and three. And what is going to grow our economy? Trade, connections, investment. That's what's going to grow our economy.
Helen, what happens if the lawyers who are investigating the ties between Iran and South Africa, if they uncover something that shows there was a direct connection, that those dots that we've looked at, what does that mean for the government of national unity? What does that mean for the DA's partnership with the ANC?
That's a very important question. Let's look at the scenario that has been mooted, and it's already been reported, and I think BizNews even reported it, that South Africa is helping Iran develop a nuclear capability and that there is cooperation there. In the scenario that I've sketched here of what is likely to develop or could develop as the worst case scenario in the world, that would be profoundly negative to South Africa with all our trading partners, not just the United States, but with the entire European bloc and even with China. So I don't think they get the big picture, and nothing will stand in the way of old loyalties that fund present crises in the ANC.
But what do you do if that comes to light, that what is being rumored is reality?
Let's double cross that bridge when we get to it, as the famous South African political saying has it. I hope it's not true. I hope it's not true. But if it turns out to be true, there will be huge repercussions.
I'm going to go to the first of our questions from the audience, from Stuart Wilmington, who says, what is the DA's official position on Iran?
The DA's official position on Iran? The DA's position on the Middle East is that we support a two-stage solution for Palestine and Israel, and that we want to end aggression there. Now, I have no mandate to speak on our official position on Iran, so I'm going to give you my official position on Iran. I think that Iran lies at a network of terror organizations that are making life terrible for the Yemeni people, that are making life terrible for the Syrians, that are making life obviously terrible in Gaza, in Lebanon, all over the place. And while Iran sees America as its greatest opponent and still wishes death to the great Satan and is developing a nuclear capability, and while President Trump has vowed to stop them doing it, it makes absolutely no sense for South Africa to openly side with Iran. That's the position.
Ken Gerber says the mainstream media remains a powerful voice and it is clearly ANC biased. Couldn't a successful government of national unity therefore be painted as an ANC success and ultimately hurt the DA in 2029?
Okay, I don't think the mainstream media are a serious player. They are perhaps a serious player amongst this kind of audience where people still read newspapers. I remember when I started my political career, if something appeared in the newspaper, everyone knew about it. Today, something appears in the newspaper, no one knows about it. If it appears on TikTok, everybody knows about it. Maybe you don't. But I had a video on TikTok this weekend that got 600,000 views, you know? So that is the audience that you're talking about. And I've got 1.5 million followers on Twitter, Alec. You've got to up your game here. So, you know, those are some of the audiences. I mean, you've seen what happened to Heidi Reichenegger in Germany, in Die Linke Party, that just absolutely flew back into the Bundestag. And the only way they ran the campaign was on TikTok. So we've got to look at that very, very carefully for the young audience. But people don't read anymore. That's one of the tragedies. They don't read anymore. And you've got to give people the information in bite-sized chunks.
But I think the context there was, if the GNU is successful, will that not punish the DA to the ANC's advantage?
Now, I think that that's an important question. Number one, we did a study about coalitions before we entered this coalition because it's obviously important to know what you're doing. And we found that not a single smaller party in a coalition anywhere except what, which was a complete outlier and an exceptional circumstance. So only one. But for the rest, there isn't a single smaller party in a coalition that has advanced at the next election. So you take a major risk as the smaller party going in to this coalition. And indeed, it was a risk that many people in the DA didn't want us to take. But we agreed to take it because the alternative was too ghastly to contemplate. So we did it. And we have to be, again, bucking the international trend and be the very first smaller party in a coalition that grows in the next election. Fortunately, the next election is the municipal election next year, end of next year, end of November, beginning of December are the dates we're looking at now. And given the collapse of municipal government where the ANC governs, we're really hoping to mobilize as many voters as we can and get them to understand that only they have the power to turn around their cities by voting the ANC out. If that message gets across, well, then we will buck the international trend and make history.
Craig Warren says, brilliant speech, Helen. How do you see job creation working with social grants, social child grants, spiking population growth, coupled to the socialist view on labor laws in South Africa?
Look, there's got to be fundamental structural reform to get economic growth happening in South Africa. The labor laws, amongst others, have to be changed to make it easier for people to start businesses, stay in business, employ people, and enable people to get jobs because they know that the employers know that they're not taking too much of a risk going down that route. That is absolutely essential. They've also got to be fundamental changes to attract investment. And it is quite clear. The BBBEE laws, apart from the insecurity of electricity supply, are among the greatest deterrents of economic investment in South Africa. And those laws haven't worked at all to empower black people broadly. Quite the contrary. Those laws have indeed enriched a tiny connected elite and made the vast majority of people poorer and poorer because they're unemployed. So we know that we would have Starlink in South Africa if it weren't for that, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. We would have a huge amount of increasing investment. We have to get rid of corruption if we want investment. We have to save billions in a spending review to redirect that money into things that grow the economy and create certainty and ensure that people believe there's a future here. And so Those are some of the things we have to do.
Is the ANC captured by those beneficiaries of BEE? And I ask this because we had a very powerful interview last week with the IRR, with Gabriel Krauss, where they quantify that the cost of BEE, the premium, the legal premium, is 150 billion rand a year. And Gabriel said, get rid of that and you can drop VAT down to 11.5%.
Well, absolutely. And if you look at preferential procurement laws, oh my goodness. Now, we're also going to challenge that in court because it just puts a huge premium on everything the state buys and costs an absolute fortune. And a spending review would have to look at that. So demanding a spending review is one of our top priorities. We want to save 60 billion from the national budget in the first round and 40 billion from provincial budgets to release into growth. And the critical things that we also need to do is fix the infrastructure, if you want. We have to concession the ports. We have to concession the rail. We have to get reliable water systems that provide clean water to everybody. Those are the stuff that we absolutely have to do. The network industries, everything has to work.
It's such a big job. We're sitting here, I'm sure, kind of scratching your head and saying, oh my goodness. But you did it in Cape Town. You did it in the Western Cape. It just seems to take time. How long might it take for our country to be operating the rest of the country like the Western Cape is?
Well, a long time ago, we decided that we weren't going to win a national election first, so we should start from the bottom up. And we could see where we could win and try and win there and try and make a difference to show that good governance actually does make a difference. And you see that also in the employment statistics, you know, where the DA governs, jobs are growing, and that's critical. Obviously, that changes the demography and has other consequences, but nevertheless, jobs are growing, and that is critical. When I became mayor in 2006 in Cape Town, the ANC had not been in power all that long and had not managed to break things down entirely. They were busy clearing out the middle level of management to deploy their cadres. They had broken down the entire functional organogram. There was quite a lot of corruption. Potholes were appearing. People weren't paying their rates. Traffic lights weren't working, all the morbid symptoms, but it was salvageable. And it was salvageable within 3 years. We could fix the finances. We started cutting people off for not paying, starting with the wealthy people in Cabs Bay and the government departments. We started balancing the budget again. We started delivering services. We eradicated corruption. We appointed the right people in the right position. And when you start getting that virtuous cycle, it takes over and lifts all ships. And then we were able to do it in the Western Cape as well, where again, the ANC hadn't been in power long enough to destroy the whole place. In Johannesburg, even the president says, my goodness, I was so embarrassed to hold the G20 in Johannesburg, which should break all of our hearts because Johannesburg is still the economic powerhouse of South Africa. And now the president wants to come in with a multi-sphere of government task force to fix Johannesburg. Now, believe me, that is just an excuse to spend public money on the ANC's election campaign because they know they're not going to become the biggest party in Johannesburg on the current trajectory. And so they want to find a way of spending public money on the ANC's election campaign. That's what they always do. And I've got that before the lawyers as well, saying, what is the legal way? Because the legal way is that there is an Intergovernment Relations Framework Act that explains how you fix local government if it's collapsing. It's not for the ANC to do it in the ANC's way. So we are determined to ensure that people know that the only way they can fix Joburg and Tshwane and Ekurhuleni and Nelson Mandela Bay and Etiquini and Mangaung is through their vote. And they must not scatter their opposition vote amongst every small party. Because as we've learnt in Tshwane and as we've learnt in Gauteng as a whole, those votes swing behind the ANC and have put Lesufi back into power. all the people who thought they were doing good by voting for Rise and BOSA and Action South Africa, etc., etc., now find that they, what they actually did was got Lesufi back into office.
Helen, it's been lovely getting the insights from you. Before we go, though, you've got this group of young leaders coming through. We have Chris Pappas, who will be here. In fact, I think Chris is probably here already, but he's going to be telling us a good news story from Mgeni, where it is a municipality where the DA has gone in and made an incredible difference. We also will have Mark Burke, who's a very, very sharp, I think he's an actuary, isn't he? But anyway, very clever.
He's an up-and-coming guru in the finance space. Yes.
On finance. He certainly knows about finance. Where do you find these people and what motivates them?
It'll be a good question to ask Mark and Chris, but let me say this. We scour the place for the best people that we can, and then we have a merit-based system that enables the best people to rise in the system. You've just mentioned Mark Burke. When I was looking at the outcomes of the interviews and the tests and everything that we run in round after round after round, I said, who's this guy called Mark Burke? I've never heard of him. And he was obviously up in the rankings there because he did very, very well in the process. Otherwise, you know, in the ANC, it's a gold watch for long service if you get a position. And the ANC has got such a terrible succession crisis because all of the old guard keep everybody out and they are allergic to talent, and talent can get nowhere in the ANC. In the DA, in every round, we want to lose 20% of our worst performing public representatives and get in the very best of the new crop. And our systems are designed to do that. And just this last Saturday in Gauteng, I ran the first Catalyst program ever, where we are scouring our metros for the very best people to turn those metros around. And we had accountants and we had lawyers in Joburg. They're sitting there saying, it's now do or die, we have to save the city. And there they come to be inducted into the reality of representative politics. So we do that. And can I just say, on Mgeni, we won Mgeni in 2021 by 42 votes. 42 votes. So if a couple of people had decided to go on holiday or do something else, Mgeni wouldn't be the success story it is today. We have to fight really smart. We have to get out every vote we can. And when we phone you 14 times on election day, don't tell us to stop phoning you. We will stop phoning you when you go and vote.
Well, there's Rob Herzog has been telling people, and he wrote on BizNews, stop giving your money to the NGOs, give it to political parties. But he's also a big supporter of Gayton McKenzie. Rob's going to be talking tomorrow. Gayton is going to be talking on Thursday. There's a question here from Johan Oordendal to close off, who says, is there a chance that the DA will work with a PA in municipal elections next year?
Political philosophy matters. Political philosophy matters a lot. And if any of you saw me doing the big triangle model that I did two BizNewses away, you will see that we are on the side of the rule of law. We're on the side of constitutionalism, non-racialism, a market economy, and all the things that go with true liberal democracy. On the other end is the EFF, and now MK has joined them there, as I said would happen, as more and more parties break off and join both sides. They stand for the leader controlling the party controlling the state controlling the economy and society. Those are the two alternative poles that are pulling South Africa in different directions. When you put Gayton McKenzie on that triangle that I drew, I have to be frank. He's a very folksy, very engaging, very charismatic, very outgoing person. You can like him a lot as an individual, but he is not on the liberal democratic side of the scale. I've been trying for a long time to get his constitution to read it, but I think what his constitution says is, I decide everything. And the trouble is with the concentration of power on one individual makes the compatibility of political philosophies, which really matters in politics, very, very difficult. And let me lastly say that of all the things that I've learned in politics, I've learned that for a political party to be successful, you need three things. Three things. You need a foundational political philosophy that is coherent and principled and to which you default in all circumstances. You go back to the principle, Helen Suzman always used to say, but you first got to know what the principle is, of course. The second is you need a huge machine, and the DA can put up a candidate in every ward from Messina to Cape Point. We've got a massive machine around the entire country. And the third is you've got to attract talent. You've got to have a depth of intellectual resources, and you've got to really attract talent, especially young talent. And there is one party that does all three, and that's the DA. No other party does. The ANC holds itself together by patronage politics. It has none of the three. And so that is why we will outlast all of our rivals unless they can build a comparable tripod on which to base their future.
Thank you, Helen Ziller.
Now you can get the cheapest Forex rate around, right here, on Shift. Pay less for your dollars, pounds, and euros here, and get to shop more here, and do more here, and enjoy more ooh-la-la here. Shift also lets you trade and transfer currencies, and buy shares in the world's best companies. It all happens right here, on Shift. You won't find a cheaper Forex rate anywhere else, no matter where you bank. Download the Shift app today.
In the world of business banking, projections, numbers, and your bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. That's why we understand that running a successful business takes endurance, drive, and partners who are willing to walk the journey with you. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
Downings is South Africa's leading marquee infrastructure company, proudly celebrating 25 years of excellence. Renowned for creativity, innovation, and unmatched technical expertise, our event marquees and semi-permanent structures elevate any project with style and sophistication. Whether it's a corporate event or a commercial project, we tailor every structure to meet your needs with world-class precision. Visit downings.co.za to consult with our expert team. Downings, your trusted marquee specialists nationwide.